You're listening to Panel Borders. I'm Alex Fitch, and this is an extract from Resonance FM's weekly show about the world of comic books. In this week's show, myself and Duncan Knott are looking at the depiction of beloved children's characters in comics. First, we have our interview with Mark Buckingham about reinventing classic fairy tales in the more adult comic Fables, but then the original tales weren't necessarily for children either, and the challenge of bringing something new to the character in his 2-year run on Spider-Man. Here's Mark in an interview we recorded at the Birmingham Comic Show while he was drawing sketches for attendees.
At the moment, you're in the middle of sketching drawings for a queue of people. What's it like just being given requests off the cuff and having to think of an interpretation of a character that you can do quickly and, you know, not have to spend too much time worrying about?
To be honest, most of the time it's actually pretty straightforward for me, because most of the things I'm being asked to draw are characters that are well established in my mind, because I've drawn them on a number of occasions in the past. So, you know, if someone asks me for a Spider-Man, I had 2 years of drawing Spider-Man. It's really straightforward. The characters I'm drawing at the moment in Fables, I've been working on for 5 years, and a lot of them I created their likenesses. So it's actually very straightforward. I always get one or two requests that are kind of a little bit strange, you know, characters that I maybe haven't even heard of. It's like, okay, you know, but it might be a favourite character of that particular fan, and they just want to see a new interpretation. And then, you know, quite often I have to beg for a little bit of reference material or something. But no, most of the time I actually find it very straightforward to just sit and sketch.
Because right now you're using a mixture of pencils and ink, so you're actually doing both jobs. Yesterday you were sketching things straight with ink onto massive flip chart paper. I mean, is that more difficult when you're working straight with ink and you have to think, oh God, if I screw that up, I won't be able to rub it out?
Yeah, it is tougher for me. I mean, it's not my usual choice of medium, and also the scale is different. I mean, that's what kind of makes it a bigger challenge. I'm much more comfortable working on sort of an A3 scale in pencil. That's really is what I do all day long, so that's my comfort zone.
It was people asking for characters that you'd drawn before, so presumably you must have sort of stock images in a way of characters that you're familiar with. You think, all right, I'm going to fill an A3 page with ink, I can just kind of like revert to this archetype. But at the same time, you also did a sketch of Stas Johnson. I mean, did that go back to life drawing classes from way back when?
Oh no, that was straight on cartooning, right? Drawing Stas. And a lot of my work has a very cartoony base. I mean, I like things to be sort of fluid and organic and to sort of bounce across the page. It's very important to me that my work has a lot of life and energy. Having said that, I mean, life drawing is important to me. I mean, I started having glasses again not long ago because I felt I needed to refresh my figure work and just change my sort of working methods a bit and kind of refresh everything. And it helped a lot. I mean, anything you do to reinvigorate your working methods and approaches is wonderful.
When you talk about cartooning, presumably the kind of projects you do vary in the terms of realism that you bring to the project. Something like Fables, even though it's fantasy art, did you find with that, because you're creating new versions of, say, classic fairy tale characters, you look towards some more classical drawings than your more cartoony stuff?
Oh gosh, yeah, I suppose when I was starting out, I mean, I spent a lot of time looking at you know, like our old books full of Arthur Rackham illustrations and things like that. You know, you're digging out, you know, original versions of Lewis Carroll and Grimm fairy tale volumes, things like that, to try and get a taste for a more illustrative approach. But I'm not comfortable with lots of sort of tones and textures, so I took elements and considered some of the sort of the feel and the flow of the piece, but not necessarily the finish. But I always find it's vital in any job that I do that I try and approach it with a new mind and a fresh eye, and to sort of bring new elements to the bear that will make it different from what I've done before.
When you worked on Miracle Man, you did a series of issues where each issue was done in a different art style. Did you take that opportunity to try out different things? I mean, I think I remember one in particular, it was a group of kids at school who were worshipping Kid Nasty Man or whatever he's called, and that was very much in the Charles Schultz style. Did it sort of give you an opportunity to say, oh, finally I can draw something in the style of Peanuts?
Well, definitely. I mean, bear in mind that the Miracle Man, when I started it, it was the first professional job, major professional job I was offered, although I did spend some time working on Hellblazer for a year while we were sorting out the contracts to actually make that happen. And when I came onto it, Neil Gaiman, my collaborator on this, the writer, was really keen to encourage me to experiment and to try different things. And we had the perfect opportunity, because we were telling a series of short stories that were reflecting different people's lives and their worldviews. And so we could tell each one in a style that we felt was comparable to that person's personality. And it was wonderful. It was my sketchbook. It was me growing up in public, allowed to experiment and try different things. And I loved it. I mean, it really was a very wonderful time, a very exciting time, because I could be anyone I wanted to be from one month to the next, or even within the same issue, I might chop and change styles three times. It was wonderful.
Like you said, you did a two-year run on Spider-Man. And I must say, your run with Paul Jenkins is one of my favourites on the comic. When it came to approaching such a well-established character, was it the joy of working on something that you think I can bring a fresh voice to it, and at the same time we're adding new characters to the universe, like his the neighbors from across the way and the dog and all that?
With Spider-Man, I mean, we tried to make it sort of fresh in a funny way by being very true to the core of the original comic. I think what made our version different in the time that it came out was that we were following a period where a lot of experimentation and a lot of changes had been made to the character, and a lot of kind of changes of direction with his life and what they were doing to his supporting cast that for us we felt were detrimental to the core of what had made Spider-Man such a good comic when we were children growing up. So really what we tried to do was to go back to that. You know, I looked a lot at the work of Ditko and Remitter, and Paul, you know, really analysed those early issues and the structure and the flow, and we wanted, you know, short story. Each issue would be a self-contained tale, there would be a lot of kind of personal stories about Peter's life and his relationship with his family and friends. And that was just, I mean, for us that was what it was really all about. You know, the fact that he would put on this costume and hit strange colourful characters for a few pages was kind of fun, but incidental to what we were trying to achieve with the book. And for, I think for the fans that were reading Spider-Man at the time, it was like a breath of fresh air that we were bringing the sort of the core of what the book was about back. But I don't think we were really setting out to kind of be particularly distinctive or radical in ourselves, although maybe, as I said, in the environment that it was appearing, it may have seemed quite different.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I suppose as well, because back then the different Spider-Man comics had more of a disparate identity from each other, and the fact that you were doing Peter Parker Spider-Man, it gave you an opportunity or almost a remit that you're going to be looking more at the human side of the character than his costume antics.
Yeah, I think that was definitely what we were setting out to do. And I bear in mind that we'd come, you know, from having done a lot of work in the Vertigo line, and I think that in itself made us acutely aware that we liked telling stories that were more personal and that people could relate to on a much more kind of down-to-earth emotional level. You know, that interplay between Peter and his friends and his aunt and the world that he lives in, and trying to make ends meet with work and his other commitments, I think that for us was really interesting and something worth paying attention to, you know, rather than just, you know, throwing him into some crazy situation with 100 villains or suddenly, you know, giving him a clone or something like that. I mean, that really wasn't what we were interested in. I mean, we didn't want to dilute what we felt was special about the comic in its original incarnation.
For a while, you did a lot of collaboration with Chris Batchelor on Gen X.
it's Ghost everybody Rider struggles Death. With his name. Oh, by the way, did you know that his name in Spanish means cod?
I do know.
Well, there you go. Anyway, yeah.
To the extent that actually the work that you did together was signed an amalgamation of your two names. I mean, how did that sort of collaboration sort of work out? Was he penciling and you inking, or did you sort of take turns?
I think it was primarily a penciler inker relationship. But what happened is that post death, when we moved to Marvel, Chris was doing Degree to Generation X. He'd also been asked to do Ghost Rider 2099. And I think what was immediately apparent to Chris was that, you know, to do both was going to be a problem for him. So the solution was developed that he would just do kind of loose breakdowns for the Ghost Rider book, and I would do a much more of a finish to it and bring lots to it myself. And so I think that helped to cement a much stronger working relationship between us, where there was a greater understanding and trust. And my own style, actually, for that period when I was working with Chris, really did kind of shift into a very similar place to Chris's own work, so that when we were doing books, or if I continued a book after he left, it would be relatively seamless. You know, we were able to sort of, you know, handle quite a few different projects, knowing that sort of look and feel would be consistent whatever we did, and whatever percentage of involvement there was from one or other of us, it would still kind of come out the same. I mean, with the Ghost Rider books, I pretty much did all the covers in the early issues, and Chris just did the first, and I did quite a lot of design work with a lot of the early monsters and elements within that series. So it really was much more of a collaborative element rather than the traditional penciler inker team.
So in a way, it really was like a gestalt entity, that sometimes readers would be getting you like 70% and sometimes they'd be getting him 50%, etc.
Yeah, I think it did work that way to a certain extent. And also, I mean the culmination of it all was with the Second Death series, where Chris, because of work commitments, had to leave the project halfway through, and I effectively just picked up my pencil and carried on as if he was still there. We brought Mark Pennington in to try and replicate my inking style, so we really did sort of maintain a look and a feel to that series that still keeps it very consistent as a read in its entirety. I really enjoyed that period of time, and I loved working with Chris, but I reached a point after that where I realised that I really needed to start to focus on my own development as an artist. And so I actually gave up inking as a part of my career in order to pencil full time and to really focus on developing my own style and my own approach to work again. So it was a very exciting period, but it was always going to be just a kind of a moment in time that I needed to sort of move on from.
My wife and I enjoying the Fables books at the moment, so I think anything that gets my wife to read it, you know, you're onto a winner there. I think it's the first one since Preacher she's really followed.
Right, that's wonderful news. Thank you. The thing is, Fables. One of the things I'm happiest about is that it's followed Sandman and Death as being one of those books that has opened the doors for a lot of new people to start reading comics, and it is. One of those series that wives and girlfriends of male comic fans find that they actually pick up and start saying, oh, I rather like this one. And I guess a lot of it is simply because, you know, whereas so many comic books are kind of focused on kind of gritty crime or kind of dramatic, epic kind of destruction and fight scenes and stuff like that. I mean, we have that kind of stuff happening in Fables, but it's also a lot about characters interacting, relationships, love, a lot of humour as well. And also, you know, it's one of those books where there is no continuity to kind of weigh it down, but at the same time these characters are well known and familiar because we've grown up with Snow White and Big Bad Wolf and all these characters, Prince Charming, we know them all, or we kind of know them all, And the nice thing about Fables is we give them all a little bit of a twist, make it kind of fresh and new, but at the same time it all feels very comfortable and familiar. And I think that's really helping to drag the readers in.
I find there are some characters who you can only do so much with because they're so well known, and I guess there might be sort of vested interests in some of them, particularly the Disney-esque ones, so you, there are more perhaps that you can play about with and sort of put in the sort of more interesting positions. And
well, I mean, yes, there are some, you know, difficulties with having to kind of be careful about which characters we choose to work with. Obviously, there are some where there are copyright issues which we kind of have to steer clear of. I mean, a prime example being Peter Pan, that we would love to have in a comic, but we're waiting for the Great Ormond Street kind of ownership of the character to expire so that we can use it without causing any headaches for anybody. And as far as Disney interpretations of characters, I mean, we have no problem with using characters that Disney have used in their films, and as long as we give them a very distinctively different take so that there's no sort of fear of we're kind of treading on their territory. But I mean, you know, this book is just very sort of different and exciting for us to work with. I mean, and we have a huge range of characters that we can draw from, because we're not just focusing on specific, you know, things like Grimm's fairy tales and what have you. I mean, we're going the whole gamut of you know, your Wizard of Oz and Lewis Carroll and fairy tales and nursery rhymes. I mean, any old sort of classic literature that can potentially fuel our range of characters and our locations and our story potential. I mean, we still haven't really gotten into Chinese or Indian folklore, and you know, I mean, there's so many sort of territories that we still need to sort of approach. We're starting to develop the Arabian stuff in the series, but I mean, so far it's primarily been European folk tales as the core of the Fables book, and then Americana as the focus for the Jack of Fables books. But as I say, there's so much more that we've still got to deal with.
Okay, so no, well, we'd like them and we'd like them, but just pacing yourself and letting it all come along in time.
We're not planning to stop anytime soon. I think the point with Fables is that we have stories we want to tell, and as we develop the characters and as those initial stories that we wanted to create are told, they're bringing up a whole new range of things that we hadn't anticipated, and often little background characters. I mean, a prime example being the Frog Prince, Flycatcher. He was really just intended to be this sort of background character, kind of a bit of just a little bit of a kind of side joke. And Bill had no intention of really kind of developing any further. And what was interesting is that he was going to get killed off in the March of the Wooden Soldiers story arc. And I really kicked up a big fuss with Bill because he was my favourite. I actually really adored the character, and I thought he's got so much potential. And he actually made Bill stop and think. And so we then sort of, you know, kept him going and started to bring more of his personality out and develop his relationships with the other characters in the cast. And we've ended up now with this whole year being dominated by a huge story arc that's just focused around him. Nobody could have anticipated that was going to happen when we started.
Have you ever been tempted to expand the remit of what fairy tales comes under? I mean, thinking of, I mean, because comic books themselves are modern fairy tales to some, thinking that they may be things like The Sandman, which have that more of that kind of mythic element to them. Have you ever been tempted to think, oh, we could just slip that one in quietly and really start blending the different histories together?
Or is that getting a bit self-referential?
I think that's a bit self-referential. It's also that thing that we don't really want to step on the toes of anybody else or to kind of complicate things by mixing ourselves in with other worlds. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I think Fables has developed so well and gained such a strong audience, is there, you don't need to have ever read any other comics to enjoy Fables. And I'm very conscious of that when I actually draw the book, because I make the storytelling as clear and straightforward straightforward as I possibly can. Not in a way that it's dull. I mean, I am quite playful, and one of the things that I'm quite known for is things like the design motifs and the border art strips that I've built into the pages that make the book very distinctive. But that was always intended to be something that's added to the experience and was something that maybe you would pick up on more through rereading, but it was never my intention to let that interfere with the straightforward experience of reading the book. And it was very important to me that someone who'd never read a comic before would be able to pick up Fables and it would all be understandable and straightforward.
I mean, essentially, actually, what you were saying about the frog character that came back because you had fun drawing with him, and give you a chance to explore that. Because I was talking to Neil a few days ago, and he said that when Charles Vess was illustrating Stardust for him, he enjoyed Charlie's drawings of some of the characters so much that he thought, oh, actually, I'm going to bring him back just because I want to see Charlie draw them again.
No, these things happen. I mean, and certainly, I'm lucky. I mean, I'm very lucky that my working relationship, which I had with Neil, was equally pleasurable, and we could really kind of throw a lot of ideas at each other. It was a genuine collaboration, and we had a great deal of pleasure just working together. It was fun. It was always fun, and that's what I've got again now with Bill on Fables. We really do feel like it's collaboration, and I'm sort of bringing elements to the stories and even sort of, you know, quite major elements at this point are sometimes coming as suggestions from me. So that for me is very satisfying and very enjoyable, and for Bill it's reassuring too, because, you know, he is effectively the creator of this series. He is the owner of Fables, but I think it means a lot to him that the people he's working with really love this series and are throwing their hearts and souls into it, and really sort of keen to help him create a rich and wonderful world for the readers.
You may well have been asked this question before, but of the big name Brits working in American comics, you're one of the few who didn't come through, I hope I'm right in saying, didn't come through the 2000 AD stable. Have you ever been tempted to have a crack at any of their characters? Or
I did actually work on for 2008, but not in the initial wave of my career. I mean, I made the leap to the American market pretty much from day one of becoming a professional comic book artist. But I always, you know, I mean, from 2008 was an integral part of my development as a comic reader and a comic fan, and I always had a soft spot for that comic and wanted to contribute something at some point. In the end, I spent a little bit of time working on a series called Tyranny Rex for 2000 AD, and around about 1992-91. I did some work for a 2000 AD special, and then I did a few issues of the regular series. I mean, the sad point was that there was nothing wrong with doing the job. I absolutely loved the job, but the problem was it was during that period when 2000 AD was part of a group of comics owned by the Maxwell Group, when they were going through their really difficult period. And I was one of the people that suffered, because I had a long wait for payment. And I'd drawn four issues and hadn't had any money yet. And I had a huge overdraft and was panicking about what was going to happen. And then I had this big check come with royalties from my first Death series with DC Comics. And I just thought, well, you know, I kind of have to make a choice at this point. And I left 2000 AD to concentrate on working for the Americans, because I felt that it was a more secure environment. I mean, obviously, that situation with 2000 AD improved very, very quickly afterwards. But the point was, I'd made that choice, and I never really went back. I mean, I did a short story for 2000 AD when Andy Diggle was the editor, and he did offer me a Judge Dredd at one point as well, not long afterwards. And I would have done it if I'd have had the time. I mean, it's just one of those things where I really enjoy 2000 AD, and I absolutely would love to do more work for it, but I have a limited amount of time, and I have to choose specific projects that I think are going to be better for me. And I must admit that for me personally, I actually prefer the format of American comics with 22 pages of story, where I can really kind of pace it in a way that's comfortable for me. I actually find it difficult working in the format and the pacing that the British comics have. It seems to be sort of more uncomfortable for me for some strange reason. But
another question that sprang to mind when you were doing the big drawings yesterday was you mentioned Mr. Easy to Draw, who would occasionally appear to add a bit of composition to some part of a frame or other. Have you got any other good tricks like that we might not have consciously spotted?
Well, not really. I mean, there are certain things that we all do to kind of get by sometimes. You know, all of a sudden, you know, doing a panel where everything's in silhouette, or I'll sometimes, you know, shift the emphasis so that, you know, we're concentrating on certain sort of elements in the foreground and the characters are just small walking past. You know, there are always going to be some tricks that you'll use to try and bring a little bit of variety and you know, difference to a sequence, or as a way of avoiding a kind of an awkward composition. But to be honest, most of the time I just kind of work at it until I get what the writer actually asked for. I mean, I don't like to kind of duck out of my responsibilities, if you know what I mean, in terms of telling the tale.
I wasn't really thinking of the ducking out. It's just as soon as you mentioned it, it was like, yes, I know exactly what you mean, but hadn't really consciously registered it as it had gone along in that way.
Oh no, it was you weren't supposed to think, Mark's trying to have saved some time by putting that really easy character in the bottom corner of the page. No, I mean, it was created for fun. Oh, yeah. I bear in mind that we had a lot of very realistic looking wildlife and animals in it, which I love to draw. I mean, believe me, that's one of the main reasons I do fables, is actually secretly I would like to be doing comics that were based entirely on wildlife rather than actually having to draw people all the time.
You didn't get to do Pride of Baghdad then.
That would have been a lot of fun, but I like the way things are in fables, the mix, the variety. And I think it was just that thing of, I thought, well, you know, there are a lot of worlds within the fables, you know, the environment, and they're not necessarily going to be all, you know, anthropomorphically, you know, kind of correct animal type characters. There's got to be some that are kind of from strange, freaky sort of, children's story realms that don't fit that look, you know. So I kind of thought, well, let's start to bring one or two of those type of characters through, so that we kind of remind people that there's no one fixed look to the way things are in those worlds.
Just watching you draw death now, do you find yourself, when you have to think in terms of being a penciler and then in terms of being an inker, you bring different techniques to the art style? I mean, you've, for example, there you've filled in a large expanse of hair by actually shading in a sort of charcoal-y style. If you were to do both the penciling and the inking on the same job, would you, for example, leave that as a blank space with fill in with ink later? Note
well,
to self.
Little X's, yeah. I mean, that's quite common. Although my decisions about things like that tend to vary depending on how I'm feeling about the work in that particular moment. At the moment, I'm going through a phase where I'm actually being quite sort of finished with the pencils, and I am filling in areas of black and keeping everything quite sort of tight and thick. There have been other times where I have pretty much just done a linear approach with a lot of kind of like X's for where those blacks go. Steve Lealoa, my collaborator on the Art of Fables, he always refers to inking those sort of pages as my checkerboard style, because he looks at the page and he starts inking, he has no idea how it's going to come out until he's finished filling in all the blacks, and it's always kind of a little bit of a, oh, that's nice, I hadn't expected that. So I do enjoy that, but I prefer to make everything as clear as possible, because obviously with things like putting in little X's instead of filling a black, sometimes when it's being being inked, it's very easy to miss that and assume that that area is actually white, or to maybe put some texture into an area where it's actually meant to be a solid black. You know, I prefer to make it as precise as possible.
If you'd like to download podcasts and get more info about tonight's show and leave some feedback, you can do so at www.panelborders.com if you click on the link marked blog. Happy Christmas.